It's spring and you want to hike, bike, hit up the farmer's market, but the last thing you want to do on a warm, sunny morning is clean house. That's where Greenland Pro Cleaning comes in. They're eco-friendly, allergy-friendly, and locally owned in Asheville. Listeners of The Overlook get a free upholstery and refrigerator cleaning upgrade with their first booking. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout. Make the most of your time this spring and visit greenlandprocleaning.com/overlook. What if Jesus were resurrected today as a stand-up comedian? Well, he might sound a lot like Robert Duback when he brings his stand-up Jesus to the Wortham Center for the Performing Arts. The creator of the Book of Mormon is back to spread his gospel about false prophets and duplicitous politicians while redeeming sinners of all faiths. Catch Stand-Up Jesus 8 p.m. May 3rd and 4th at the Wortham Center. Find details and tickets at worthamarts.org.
I am a maker, a builder, a baker, although sometimes my messes are all that you'll find. I'll tell a story, both true and allegory. Oh, the process is precious, though it takes up all my time.
The Buncombe County District Attorney's Office prosecutes dozens of cases every week, from capital murder to trivial infractions. But DA Todd Williams seems at least a bit frustrated by the public's lingering interest in what, on paper, resulted in guilty verdicts for misdemeanor trespassing. Some are holding up the charges as veiled attacks on freedom of the press.
There's been a substantial transparency about this. The body cams have been released. They're in a park. The park is closed. The park is closed to everyone.
This is The Overlook with Matt Pikin, a podcast about the news, arts, issues, and trends of Asheville, North Carolina. Todd Williams is in his 10th year as district attorney. We covered a lot of territory in my conversation with him last year. If you haven't dialed into it, I urge you to go back and give a listen over two parts. I thought it was time to invite Williams back for a postscript. We talk in depth about the charges leveled at two people who produce work for the online media outlet The Asheville Blade. That dovetails into a larger conversation about the news media and the conduct of journalists. We also talk about the importance of his department's relationships within Asheville Police and with judges, along with the application of prosecutorial discretion. On election day a few weeks ago, I saw Todd Williams standing on the edge of the parking lot of my polling place, wearing a sticker and carrying literature for District Court judicial candidate Meredith Presley. This surprised me, so I opened the conversation by asking him about it.
As a citizen, I have a First Amendment right to, you know, express my perspective on that. I did put a sticker on, and I was there to represent for Meredith Presley, who served the Office of District Attorney for 16 years extremely well, and I think she'll be a very good district court judge. And her opponent, Todd Lentz, I like very much too. I'll just go ahead and throw that out. He's a great guy, very experienced defense attorney in the community. But my allegiances lie with Meredith, who served, you know, on my staff for almost 10 years now.
Yeah, I understand. But it just surprised me in your public role as district attorney. You're in a kind of a law enforcement position, and you wouldn't want to think that whether it's the police chief, county sheriff, district attorney, that you have a cozy or not cozy relationship with a certain judge, and that plays a role in how you conduct business.
I'm absolutely confident that Meredith Presley will be able to set aside any kind of, I did make a $250 contribution to her campaign. That's public record, but I didn't make any public endorsements. I didn't make any public statements.
I guess I wanted to talk about the larger topic of the political nature of your position, wherever it is. Any district attorney who is an elected official, talk about how politics plays into, or how you try not to have it play into, even though it is an elected position and you were there campaigning. So you would think on the surface you would prefer to have one judge over another judge for whatever your reasons are. Talk about the public perception around that.
My goal as district attorney is to always enforce the law. And you know, last time we were here, we talked a lot about the exercise of discretion. We prosecute conduct A judge evaluates the facts of the case. In district court, they serve as a judge and a jury. They assess the facts and the law and apply the facts to the law and decide guilt or innocence, quite frequently, if they're in the criminal court rotation. And I will say, just to insert, Meredith Presley will have to go to the family court. My office can't appear in front of her for a period of time. I think there's a regulation, at least 6 months. And it's very possible she might be elected and serve as a judge indefinitely in a role where she does not have contact with the district attorney's office. So I know Ms. Presley very well. I know that she can set aside those relationships, just as in our role in the DA's office, we're evaluating the facts. We're not prosecuting politics. We're not prosecuting, you know, we don't like your agenda. We don't like your Facebook page. We're looking at what is the conduct, right? And that's the same obligation that a judge owes. And you know,
so why do you choose you specifically or any, why would any district attorney publicly endorse one judge over another as a candidate?
This was an open seat, right? If this were a question of incumbency, that'd be different. But, you know, if Mr. Lentz had won, I spoke to Todd very frankly about it, and I told him that I was going to have limited involvement and that I thought he would be a good judge too.
On the outside looking in, and you just said people can put aside what your relationship is to adhere to the law and go by the facts in a case, and whatever evidence is laid out, that's how a judge can look at things. But you can't help but think this is a business of relationships to some degree. You know, you and your colleagues in the district attorney's office and the defense attorneys go before the same judges regularly. You get to know them fairly well. How important are relationships between your office and judges and even defense attorneys who you work with on every case? You're trying to reach agreements or pleas. How important are these relationships?
There's certainly a range. I think that there are attorneys that I would say that I have a very good personal relationship with and have supported my campaigns for district attorney in the past, but are some of the most difficult attorneys to work with in the forum of the courtroom. From the outside looking in, a lot of folks think that it's an old boy thing. There's a relationship. I get the perception, but it's possible to have a good relationship with someone and also not forfeit and not concede a single solitary thing in service or in tribute to something that's irrelevant to the disposition of a case.
There isn't a situation where, hey, you gave me this in this certain case, I will grant you this in this certain case. Like, is there any, if not
Look,
a quid pro
that,
quo?
That's wrong.
Okay, I'm just putting that out there. I wonder if that's a perception.
That kind of thing would be absolutely improper. I will tell you that years ago, that kind of thing has come up where folks have in high dudgeon kind of thrown down the glove and said, I wouldn't have supported you if I'd known it was going to come out like this. And it's sorry, I'm elected as district attorney, and I would like to maintain that good, positive relationship and your support. But in this case, I can't consider those things. The evidence is here. The law is here. The victim needs justice.
Yeah.
And that's the way that goes. We can't sell ourselves. What's the old maxim? Once you do it once, it's easier the next time.
We covered a lot in our last conversation. I listened back. I thought we covered a lot of ground. And yet there's some things that are still open cases and there's things that are still happening. And I want to try to do a postscript on some of the conversations that we started last time. The one case that was a hot topic at the time was the Aston Park case.
Sure.
And while some of it has been, quote, settled, there's now still appeals. There's things ongoing with that case. And when I posed a question on an Asheville Politics Facebook page stating, I'm going to be talking again with District Attorney Todd Williams, what would you like me to ask him? It was remarkable to me that the Aston Park case is still such a hot button topic for a number of people. And there's been some back and forth in the courts that a federal court judge ruled not long ago that the activists have evidence supporting a suit that the city unlawfully banned them from city parks based on the First and 14th Amendment. Some people believe these trespassing charges are just a cover for trying to mute journalists who are policing the police in a way that isn't desirable. I'm just wondering if you can expound a little bit on why you chose to prosecute these cases?
I have to take great care because there are pending matters, as you've just indicated. Where we are right now is the trespassing matters have been concluded. And those cases involved two defendants named Coit and Bliss. And they're now on appeal. I can talk pretty openly about those two cases. Everybody has their right to their day in court, and the state is obligated to prove charges beyond a reasonable doubt. So we have the two trespassing cases. That's done. I can speak about those.
So Matilda Bliss and Veronica Coit, you said those trespassing charges are settled now, that they were both found guilty of trespassing.
Case was tried.
Misdemeanor,
secondary trespassing.
Right. To your knowledge, has your office prosecuted before this incident, before the umbrella of the Aston Park charges, have you ever prosecuted misdemeanor trespassing charges before?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And so in that case, there was a novel defense, you know, posited that we're reporters, and as reporters, we have First Amendment protections to cover an event. And so you're right there on the line of, are you covering an event or are you violating the law? But I did upload Judge Davis's order, which will answer all your questions about the defense and whether or not a First Amendment privilege or protection might apply as a defense in this case. There was plenty of hearing about that, plenty of evidence about that, and it was denied. And he wrote, I don't want to say 8 or 10 page order on it.
What's your feelings on this? Because I'll tell you.
Time, place, and manner.
Let's talk about manner. If you're covering something, something's happening at a certain time and place, you as a journalist, you go there. It could be a midnight, it could be 2 in the morning, even in the afternoon, whatever. And if it's something you're interested in covering, that's the time and place. The manner is what I want to focus on. What made this manner of these two people representing Asheville Blade different?
We have to keep in mind that this event... And there's been a substantial transparency about this. The body cams have been released. You can go to the Asheville YouTube channel and find the videos. They're in the park. The park is closed. The park is closed to everyone.
Yeah,
right?
But, okay, again, as a journalist, and I've worked my entire career in journalism, if you're there legitimately covering, when I say legitimately, objectively covering something, that you're there to witness, hey, there's police behavior here that somebody needs to be witnessing, regardless of whether we've been told by police to leave. I think to maintain your integrity as a journalist, you do what you can to put yourself in a position to witness that, even if it's going against police orders, because you may not trust that police have the public's interest at heart at that point. My question, and I was not there to see how Matilda Bliss and Veronica Coit were conducting themselves, but the Asheville Blade has readily said they oppose police. There is an advocacy journalism happening that you mentioned a few minutes ago. Where is the line? And to me, the question is, where do you cross the line from journalist to advocate to a participant, being a participant?
Well, that's not, those aren't issues that we were concerned with.
Okay, then if you're not concerned with them.
So, I mean, as a citizen, we can all certainly ask those questions about the credibility of the news source and what.
But that comes into play here.
The secondary trespassing is, the crime is remaining in a place where you're not permitted to remain.
Okay.
So that's it.
So
and
let
the park
me ask
was
you
closed
that,
at a certain time.
Yeah.
And I have to say again, APD was extremely professional that night. You can look at the body cam footage. They made numerous requests for everyone to leave, and there wasn't, you know, any excessive use of force. There wasn't APD themselves weren't. They were enforcing a generally applicable ordinance, you know, and they have had problems previous in that park and others. The mission is to preserve this public space for everyone's use. And we can't identify what a person's politics or what a group's politics are and then prosecute based on that. If we had the Ku Klux Klan or someone do something similarly, the community would say, we want those folks jailed immediately. I mean, because Asheville is, in terms of its politics, where it is. So we can't create a precedent, because then we're looking at selective prosecution. We're looking at other questions about the DA's office downstream.
I totally understand that. But let's say, okay, so I, as a journalist, I notice the police, they're removing people from the park.
So here's an answer. Police do put up crime scene tape here, right? But a journalist hears about a shooting or whatever in a certain place. The crime scene tape is up to preserve the crime scene, right? Now, it's not totally applicable in the analogy to the park, but the park is closed. The perimeter of the park, it's closed, but you can see into the park from the perimeter. Right. So
to a degree,
Man.
And let's just say it's not to a close vantage and you can't hear what's happening.
Right. So I don't know precisely where the subject was in an encampment that night.
But I think,
where the tents were set up. I don't know. I don't know how close the sidewalk was. I don't have the answers to those things. I'd have to go back and look at the body cam too. Again, there's a lot of transparency that people could look at.
I understand that. But again, time, place, and manner. And I would think manner is wholly relevant here because let's say, now I would have certainly, from what I could tell from what body cam footage I saw, I would have conducted myself somewhat differently than the people representing the Asheville Blade did. What I would have done is said to the police, look, I know you're trying to clear the camp. I know you're trying to clear the park. I need to just be here witnessing. Can I be behind you? Can I be along with you behind you as you do this? And to distance myself from the people who are being removed, but being up close. Now, if the police had still said, we don't want you here, that's where the problem is. And I would think, let's say I were arrested at that point because I did not follow the police's orders. I do have a First Amendment and 14, I have a 14th Amendment right to witness and be a member of the press, but I'm being told by law enforcement that I'm in violation of a curfew that and the police telling people
it's not
to
a
leave.
Curfew. It's the park is closed after a certain
right.
An owner has the right to exclude persons from their property, and you know the maintenance of the park requires that the park be closed for a period of time. That's a community level decision that has been made.
Totally, I am not debating that. I am saying that in this instance, when police are called in to, or for whatever reason, they are there to remove people from the park, that witnessing police behavior, there is a role there for the press and it's constitutionally protected. I guess I want to come to your office and ask, where do you choose?
Yeah.
Not this specific case necessarily, but when are press responsibly doing their job and the police still don't want you there, where do you come in to say, we're not going to prosecute this, or we are.
So, yeah. So now we're getting back to the question of discretion. And the question comes back to how good are the facts? Again, APD, if they were high-handed, heavy-handed, used excessive force, were anything less than the patient professionals that they evinced themselves to be that night, maybe we would have had a situation where we don't think that this case is fully triable in front of a Buncombe County jury. And so that's, again, this case was, it's fine to debate about it. I can talk about it now, but you know, we had 12 jurors hear the facts and see all the material, see the body cam, hear from the officers themselves. And I can't recall whether or not Quentin Bliss testified, but potentially hear from them as well. And so all that was weighed and they were found beyond a reasonable doubt to be, you know, trespassing. And so again, hey officer, I'm with the press. I want to just stand over here and observe. I'm not going to get in your way at all. I'm not going to obstruct. I'm not here for that purpose. Can we work a deal? If the officer says, no, I don't know who you are. Other officers might say, this guy could be a security issue. At some point, it's like, how credible are those claims? In our discretion, we might say the officers are using it as a pretext and the evidence might not be good enough to present to a jury and we might not prosecute that. So again, you've heard the expression, lawyers don't like hypotheticals, right? So we're chasing rabbits, but in this case, as the facts were presented, APD behaved very professionally, very well. You have questions as a journalist about how the Blade reporters behaved, right? So we presented the case, and a jury came back guilty on that.
More after this.
When you go to an Asheville City Soccer Club game, you're not just watching soccer, you're welcomed into what players and fans call the South Slope Blues.
The South Slope Blues, they're amazing.
This is the coach of the women's team, Brooke Bingham.
The atmosphere is what makes Asheville City Soccer so great.
Longtime player Laura Greb.
We have the most dedicated fans. We have our South Slope Blues. They post up in the corner of the field every game. They've got their drums, they've got their smoke, they've got their loud voices. You can hear them for miles.
Elite men and women players from throughout North Carolina team up in Asheville for a two-month season against other aspiring pros from all over the Southeast. Home games this season begin May 18th at Greenwood Field on the UNC Asheville campus. For details, tickets, and your first steps into the South Slope Blues, visit Asheville City Soccer Club at AshevilleCitySC.com. When you come to questions of discretion in general, are those questions always about, do we have enough evidence here to prosecute? Is that the sole element of discretion?
No.
Talk
no,
about what else you weigh.
No, we talked about this last time, and I appreciate this question greatly because, like, speeding tickets, we generally have very good evidence to show that somebody was, we generally give reductions. If Matt Pikin, sorry to personalize it, but if someone named Matt had a speeding ticket and a clean driving history, we might just say, hey, Matt, slow down. We'll dismiss this. We'll give you a freebie on this one. Drug treatment court. We run drug diversion programs. We have good evidence in those cases, right? So it's not just that. It's trying to achieve the aims of justice and trying to get justice case by case. And I will say that the Coyton Bliss cases are done long before the trial. We invited those defendants to do some volunteer work, some clean up a park, right? And all those offers were rejected out of hand. We exercise discretion to try to seek a disposition short of guilty verdicts in that case.
This isn't something you can necessarily comment on, or this is gets to the more the journalism element. I don't like that we're in an era when anyone can say they're a journalist. If they have a phone that can film, if they are there as a witness, I am a journalist. If they have a blog, whatever their outlet is, I am not saying the Asheville Blade in particular is that. They have been around a while. And I don't know the answer to this. I literally do not know where the line of demarcation is between who can legitimately call themselves a journalist and who can't, for the sake of being out in the public and trying to represent the public's interest in witnessing something. That said, and I'll get off the soapbox in this after I say this.
That's very interesting.
I do think it denigrates journalism, denigrates the work of career journalists that anybody with an outlet can say they are a journalist, no matter what their agenda is, no matter what their manner of how they execute their job and gather information. And I think it hurts journalism. And we're at an all-time low in terms of trust for journalism right now. Public polling shows that, I can't remember the percentage, but it's a minority of people trust the media. And I think that has a lot to do with it now. They expect the media to take sides. And when you get to the Asheville Blade, they are unabashed in taking sides in terms of the journalism they do. And I think that is part of the manner in which maybe this case, they sought their journalism.
So I don't want to talk about the Asheville Blade in particular, but journalism and journalists in general, there are acknowledged standards. When an individual says the Buncombe County DA X, Y, and Z, and they want to print that quote, I think a generally acknowledged standard is reach out to the Buncombe County DA for a response, right? So when you have professional standards that are known and understood, and I think there are some journalistic governing bodies that have promulgated best practices for journalists, you come to expect that. And frankly, and I'm not talking about the Blade, I've been disappointed on numerous occasions to see an individual make a comment about a case or the DA's office or whatever their practice, and I learn about it after it's already run. If you had given me an opportunity to comment, I would have explained. And like, you know, 18, 24, 36 hours before I've noted that this thing's gone out, that I've been able to provide the statement or comment, and it gets plugged in on the website, but everybody's already seen the viral video or whatever else. And it is very frustrating to be on the receiving end of that.
You mentioned a little bit ago, again, one of the themes we're talking about here is discretion. And I'm wondering if the seriousness of the charge
at all plays a role in whether you choose to devote resources to it or not. And one of the things that has come up is prosecution of cannabis charges and drug-related charges. I know last time we talked, you talked a lot about diversion programs and other things that your office is working with, including other agencies and nonprofits, to help steer people away from being prosecuted in court for do I have that right? Am I saying that correctly? Yeah. One of the questions came up was, what's your stance now that cannabis, the laws are evolving around the country, and where does your office stand in terms of cannabis related charges?
Yeah. So again, this is a case by case discretionary consideration that we have. And the law in North Carolina is still what it is. Personally, I would like to see them change the law and fully decriminalize it. It's still a class 3 misdemeanor. I think in my role as district attorney, I can have my personal views about that, but my official views are it's still against the law. And case by case, as cases are presented, we're going to make a decision to prosecute or not.
Based
on the evidence, and in that hemp is legal, there's no smell test, there's no I know it when I see it kind of thing. They're extremely difficult to prosecute at this juncture. I will concede that publicly. So our priority is dangerous street drugs, and we all know what they are, fentanyl and anything that fentanyl is put into, which can be just about anything, including sometimes cannabis. But we're prosecuting increasingly the fentanyl and the dangerous street drugs that can take life. That's our priority.
You've been in office now for 3 terms, right? This is your third.
Yeah, it's been 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years. So are you trying to do things differently philosophically now than you were maybe when you first came into office? I asked you something similar in our last conversation. You brought up the death penalty a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering if philosophically, from a prosecutorial vantage point, if you're just coming about things differently now than you were maybe 7, 8, 9 years ago.
Well, so the law in the community, the legal environment together with community is in evolution. So the DA's office is compelled to evolve parallel to those other developments. I ran on expanding prosecutorial discretion, which was we're going to operate more treatment courts, we're going to operate diversion programs, we're going to do those things. A number of people said, as a progressive district attorney candidate who was at that time a capital defender, a career public defender, you should come out and make an express declaration that you will not seek the death penalty. And I opted not to do that because I felt that it was inconsistent to say I'm going to expand prosecutorial discretion over here, but I'm not going to use prosecutorial discretion in these other cases. And so I have been public that I'm against the death penalty, but in my official role, I will exercise discretion and I will evaluate those cases on the merits. As soon as I was elected in 2015, about 10 weeks in, we had the case involving Robert Jason Owens and a married couple, 6-month pregnant mom to be, went missing, and then their human remains were found in his buck stove. And it's just an absolutely gruesome case. We have prosecuted some cases. We have charged the death penalty. We have disposed of those cases short of the death penalty. And I'm sure there are plenty of people that disagree gravely with me on those things. No pun intended on grave. But I want to say we remain committed to prosecutorial independence, the use of prosecutorial discretion to achieve justice. We remain committed to operate treatment courts and diversion programs. I'd be more than happy to create new treatment courts and diversion programs if the resources avail themselves and it can be shown that they further the interest of justice. I don't want to say that the office hasn't evolved, but the office does remain committed to its the values as stated in 2014.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your relationship with APD. I know they've had a revolving door of chiefs. And I'm wondering, Mike Lamb has been in this community a long time. I'm sure you and your colleagues in the DA's office know him very well. We talked very beginning of this conversation about relationships. How important is a relationship with a particular police chief and their way of working in terms of the cases that come to you and how you work with them to prosecute cases? Does it make a difference who the chief of police is?
Certainly. It's always a good thing to have a good relationship with an agency head. But again, it's case by case. It's the quality of the investigation. It's not the quality of the agency head. And that's not necessarily always relevant. Chief Zach was generally good to work with. He did make some statements that I was frustrated by in terms of the unhoused community, the prosecution or not of vagrancy crimes, which I thought were unfortunate and misleading to the community. But I'll just say that when you're working person to person with agency heads, the sheriff, mayor, you know, what have you, and the community, other county commission, you just can't take things personally. I had a good relationship with Dave Zach. He made some comments that I had to push back on, and I went to the city manager on and some other things and provided to the press. And there was a little bit of a flail X and a public squabble, but in the end, I understand you're representing your agency, I'm representing mine. Let's get the work done today. That was yesterday. And it's really incumbent on us all to water off a duck's back and just keep it moving.
Last thing I guess I want to ask you about, and I talked to you about this on our last conversation, that your office uses its own media channels, whether it's Twitter and you're getting off of that or scaling that back, but you're going to Substack. And I thought it was interesting that you, while it's free, that there's a statement on there that you could pay to subscribe to the district attorney's.
I'm sorry, I don't do the look. Substack, apparently anybody can access it free.
Yes,
and it's on bunkumda.org.
Yes.
And I don't know if that bug says, I guess that's Substack's business model. I'm not interested in having anybody pay. I wanted to get off Twitter because I'm concerned about, frankly, the hate speech that's on Twitter increasingly. I don't want to be on that platform so much. And Substack allows, it's somewhat a professional looking interface that seems to be good for press releases. And it also integrated the API. I'm not a techie, but it integrated well with the website, and I could show the feed on my website, which is what I wanted. Can you believe I actually do this myself? I don't have
you do?
A media person. And yeah, and so Substack gave me an API. I don't even know what that is, that I could plug in on bunkumda.org, and the feed from the Substack would appear there.
Oh, I didn't know you did that yourself.
So when you look at the website and you say, this thing is a piece of, it's almost all Todd Williams that's put that thing together. My intent is that I just want anybody who wants to read these things to have access to them. It's interesting, too, getting back to the media. I release these press releases, and I talk to my assistants. I craft these things. I put sometimes very precise language in there to say what needs to be said, what I feel needs to be said. And then the media will then edit it for some other purpose to make it more readable or something. And they take out stuff that you changed the meeting and now it doesn't mean what it said.
Hey, reporters have that same problem with editors. We turn in stories to editors and they change the meaning. They change the words. So sometimes it might have our name on the story. We go, that's not how I put it. And we get in arguments with our editors all the time.
Yeah.
So is there anything we haven't talked about that you
want to? Well, I thought we were going to talk about e-courts.
Let's talk about e-courts.
I just said that I would start any program. I would consider any sustainable new initiative that furthers the aims of justice. But I'll do that probably in 2025, because here in 2024, we are covered up with this transition from paper to this electronic portal that the Administrative Office of the Courts, governs the operation of courts in the state of North Carolina. We're a unified court system. We're scattered around 100 counties. We have 100 clerks of court throughout the state. We have 43, I believe, maybe 44 district attorneys. We have public defender offices, and maybe again, I forget what the number is now, 20, 30, 40 districts across the state. We're all going to go from, yes, a unified court system that does have some sort of state direction, but we operate within our counties the way we've always done it, right? This is the way we've always done it. We don't do it the way they do it in Madison or Haywood County necessarily. It's different over there. We're going to have this interface that the state has bought from Tyler Technologies imposed on us statewide. And AOC came to Buncombe County in a week or so ago, and they said this is the biggest change in our court system.
What's this agency that you said came?
Administrative Office of the Courts.
Okay.
Folks from AOC and Raleigh came to Buncombe County and said, we're here to help you transition as of July 22nd to e-courts. And this is the biggest transition in the court system since 1967, when they went from a local county court, magistrate, municipal judge type thing to statewide unification. So it's the biggest thing since then.
How does that functionally change the way you operate or the way things go?
We're waiting to see. Initial rollout in Wake County and Johnston County and Harnett counties, which is a large county, Wake County, a medium-sized county, Johnston County, and then a small county, Harnett County, all in the center of the state, was not very successful. There was a lot of latency issues. There's talk of this spinning wheel of death where you pull an individual's name up and the system is non-responsive. And when you're trying to deal with several hundred traffic citations, you can't wait 2 to 5 minutes to pull up a case. There's a lawyer or a group of lawyers who have alleged that this system has hurt their practices. These folks are engaged in traffic law, and they'd like to do 50 to 100 traffic citations in whatever time frame, maybe a day. And now they're down to, they can only do a handful.
So let me just ask you.
Because the system is slow.
So e-courts, just to be clear, it's just a way of having uniform filing of cases statewide. That's what this is.
It's virtual. It's going to be paperless.
So you can, anybody can access the case files and pay fines this way, but it doesn't change the way the courts operate, right? It doesn't change how cases are prosecuted or charged. No.
It's like discretion and all these other things. No.
Is your office at full strength? Do you have full staffing, or are you guys short?
As of this date, March 26th, we're down technically two positions. We're losing one grant position in the next month or two, so we're not going to hire for that. And the second one should be filled as of April 8th. So we're effectively fully staffed. I enjoy coming on your podcast. I got a lot of good feedback. I think your podcast reaches people that I think are interested in hearing from me, and certainly, and other electeds. And anyway, I appreciate the opportunity.
If you value the Overlook's place in Asheville's media landscape, please consider joining dozens of others who are supporting the show through my Patreon crowdfunding page. Become a member for as little as $5 a month. Visit patreon.com/theoverlookpodcast. Our First Look newsletter gives you just a handful of daily headlines from around the local media landscape to get you on your morning. We also have a weekly newsletter devoted to all things The Overlook that hits you every Friday. Both are free and available at podavl.com/newsletter. I want to thank my guest today, Buncombe County District Attorney Todd Williams. Our conversation happened inside the BB Theater, where the owners Susan and Giles Collard of Asheville Contemporary Dance Theater have been so gracious enough to allow me to conduct my interviews there. The theme song for The Overlook, Maker Song, comes to us courtesy of the Asheville duo The Resonant Rogues. The Overlook is a production of Podcast Asheville. New episodes come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on any social media channel at AVL Overlook. And I'll see you on the next episode of The Overlook with Matt Pikin. Hey everyone, Matt Pikin here from The Overlook, and I'll get back to my conversation in just a moment. But I'm asking you, the listener, yes, you, listening this very moment, is The Overlook making a difference in your connection to Asheville? Do you know more about what makes this city tick and where we're struggling? If you had to give up one cup of coffee every month to do your part to keep this show going, would you step up? If you answered yes to any of that, and I really hope you did, please join dozens of other listeners by supporting The Overlook with Matt Pikin through my Patreon campaign by giving just $5 a month. Give at higher levels and you'll earn free tickets to my live podcasting events. Your support means the world to me and helps keep this show free for anyone to hear. Go to patreon.com/theoverlookpodcast.